This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting live and worldwide from Pod Bay 2A at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. Can you feel it, Ben?
I can feel it. My hands are on the radio, and I can feel it coming through.
So we're talking over Fiendphone, continuing tests with Fiendphone. And you can go to fiendphone.com. That's Foxtrot Echo Echo November Phone.com. It's a new software program that my friend Derek and I are developing to change the world, to allow people to speak clearly for free to each other.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, we are still in the alpha stage of testing, correct?
Yeah, Alpha Centauri, whatever. We'll see. So, Ben, where are you today? Where is your van that you drive around in the country solving mysteries parked?
Or don't I'm you in a mysterious say? I'm in a mysterious location somewhere between Pensacola, Florida and Mobile, Alabama, near an abandoned amusement park. And seriously, near an abandoned amusement park.
Wait, isn't that the plot of like every episode of Scooby-Doo ever?
There is literally swamps around us. There's an abandoned amusement park. There's like a swamp with a fallen giant fiberglass mouse half sunk into the swamp. It's very creepy.
A mouse. That's weird. Wow. So what else have you been up to in your quest for liberty?
Mostly just living free, enjoying life. Going from campground to campground, paying cash, disappearing off the radars, off out of the mind of the government that watches us constantly. You can't do that though, because if you connect to the internet, it's very difficult not to be seen by those people because they're pretty much watching everything now.
Yeah, we'll have to later. Maybe down the line, we'll develop like Black Wallet Fiend Phone. You know, the Fiend Phone that mixes your conversations with other people and you can't be seen. But yeah, man. So I think that living free on your own is a better plan than trying to change the government to allow you to be more free, because they're not going to. You know, they're going to do what they're going to do. You can't vote them correct. You can't protest them correct. You can't even shoot the SOBs, and I don't recommend that. And it's a waste of bullets too. So yeah, man, I think the thing is just be free in your own head. It sounds like a childishly simple solution, but it is a better solution than waving signs and trying to get things different, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, because, you know, the government has a vested interest in keeping everything exactly like it is and only modifying, you know, only making it more palatable to the extent that they absolutely have to. And then, you know, government oppression, I've said this a lot of times, government oppression is kind of like a big giant balloon. If you mash into it in one spot, it just bulges out someplace else.
Yeah.
So if you fight and you get the votes out and you do all the stuff to get this one law that's your pet project, you get it repealed or you get it modified or you get it softened or whatever you do, government's just going to expand out in some other direction that you're not noticing. You're not accomplishing what you think you're accomplishing. It's part of the giant myth that is, you know, this false vision that you can change government and make it better. You really can't. It's evil and it just keeps getting more and more oppressive. All you can do is guard yourself and your family. Teach your family how to work around. And the workaround is really the key. Whether we're talking about, you know, on the internet or in your daily life or in your job or whatever, you look for workarounds. That's the essence of being like a life hacker, if you want to coin a phrase like that.
Well, that phrase exists. You don't need to coin that phrase. I mean, if you want to use a coined phrase.
Steal somebody else's coin.
But, you know, really, really, it's not stealing, too. And I mean, all words are made up. All phrases are made up. you know, they say that Shakespeare coined 10% of the words that he used. I've heard that. I haven't fact-checked that, but I know he coined a lot of words and phrases, including he coined the phrase to coin a phrase. Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not against activism. I think, I admire people who do activism. I get kind of irked by people who do like define themselves so much as an activist that they get angry at people who are not activists. The people who are the most effective activists are people who really like being activists, you know, who live for it, who are like, yeah, I'm going to court today and that's what I do. Or, yeah, I'm going down to, you know, question my representatives with a camera in their face and or any other number of activist things. But not everybody.
That's just one aspect.
Yeah, it's just one aspect, too. You know, it's like, I mean, whoever created Bitcoin, I think, is the greatest activist ever. And I wouldn't be surprised if that guy, like, never left his house. You know, it seems like that kind of person, like he was anonymous. He didn't give much information about who he really was. He was not a, I want to take credit for this great thing I've done. Like, you know, nobody knows really who Satoshi Nakamoto is. I'd say that guy did more for the movement forward of liberty. I don't even like the word liberty movement or even liberty mission, your term. It's because liberty is an individualistic thing. And if I had to be defined by everything that everyone in the liberty movement does, I would hide in a dark room. And I kind of do not leave the whole, I don't go out in the streets much. I leave the house, but I'm not a march in the streets with signs kind of guy. But, you know, I think that there are different kinds of what you might call activism, and I think some can be done anonymously. I think that that is a great form of activism. I think that what Derek and I are doing, you know, creating Fiendphone is a form of activism. I think it'll improve the sound quality of Liberty Media. And, you know, the independent media is never taken seriously. It's not taken seriously at all if it sounds bad. But if you can get the audio quality up to the level of the mainstream media, I think it has a chance. You know, it's, I mean, you can't tell people something as mind blowing as, you know, all government is immoral and there's no fixing it. I mean, telling people that is like telling them up is down and green is red. You know, it's a mind blowing concept to most people to even hear in high fidelity, you know, but to hear it like over most podcasts, which sound there and a lot of internet radio shows that sound like, you know, people speaking from the bottom of a well through a tin can on a string, they're really not going to get it. So I've put a lot of my, I'm not an out in the street kind of guy, but I try to do things that make a difference and I do things that interest me. And I really think that's the key. I mean, of course it's good to try things that challenge you, but you know, if you try activism and you're going to be nervous about it the first time you're out in the street with a sign or with a video camera. If you're nervous about it but still like it, then keep doing it. But if you're nervous about it and it kind of just really, you don't like doing it, you don't need to keep doing it because some people tell you, oh, you have to be an activist. You know, there's different kinds of activism. I would also say, like, kind of not even everybody has to do something. You know, a society is made up of, you know, I would say providers and sellers. And I mean, it's not a great analogy because it's kind of like saying, well, some people do the activism and other people just sit on their couch. But, you know, for instance, like something like Bitcoin, it was a great idea that has never been done. And it solved a problem that people have been trying to solve since the 70s. But if people hadn't adopted it, it would be useless. And so really, like, everyone who uses and engages in commerce with Bitcoin is being an activist in a way. And it's kind of an armchair activist, but it's like, you know, if you're doing something that is a network effect like Bitcoin, where like one person using it is useless, two people using it is worth a little more, a million people using it, it's worth a lot more. If you're one of those million people, you are contributing to the market of something that's good and new. Whereas, you know, somebody out in the street with a sign saying Bitcoin is great, I mean, there's usefulness to that, but really it's like we say that the market would take care of everything, and being part of the market is almost a form of activism. And I don't even necessarily mean like giving money to activists, but that's good too. But if you are participating in something with a network effect like Bitcoin or like Fiendphone, you are increasing the worth of the whole network for every single node on it.
You know, I really think you're hitting on an aspect of truth there, because it's so easy for a person who's involved in street activism to look at the risk that they're taking, look at the high level of energy that they're putting into what they're doing, and it's really easy for them to fall into the trap of thinking that anybody who's not doing what I'm doing is sitting on the couch doing nothing. And this is a really common thought among street activists. And I'm not taking anything away from street activists. You know, Derek Jay, one of our co-hosts, you take something like what Anthony Buehler's doing down there in Texas, what Ian Freeman has done up in New Hampshire, what some of them have done in Washington, D.C. with the lemonade stuff and the fresh and the raw milk stuff. All of that stuff is really important, but it's not the entire world. If you can take what our programmer, a different Derek, but if you can take what our programmer has done, Derek with Fiend Phone, and you take what Cody Wilson's doing with his projects, and what Satoshi did with Bitcoin, that kind of stuff lays the underworking that maybe you don't see it. I talked about programming one time, or several times I've talked about programming like this. Looking at a program is kind of like looking at a mountain. All you really see is the outer shape and the grass and the rocks and the trees. You don't see what's underneath that entire mountain. And there's a massive quantity of stuff underneath that grass and trees and rocks. And that's what programming is. It's layers and layers and layers of work to get the thing that you see when you wiggle your mouse and push that button. And that's what guys like Cody Wilson and Derek, our programmer, have done. They have laid layer after layer of rock, of foundational stuff that's going to be around for generations. And, you know, not to take away from anything that the street protesters or whatever do, but that stuff oftentimes, once it's over, it's over. But something what Derek is doing with Fiend Phone is creating something for the future that even if Fiend Phone goes away, it's cutting into the ground to make a new path for new stuff that's going to come along too. And that's just as important, at least as important.
Well said, man. Well said. Yeah. Code. They say that computing done right is poetry over math. And if it's done right, you don't see the math.
Yeah. That's nice. I like that. As an ex-programmer, I like that.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Michael. On the radio.
On the radio. So you can drop some mad scientists here, Ben. Lay it on me.
Yeah, well, you know, we were talking about how important different types of activism are, you know, whether you're talking about street activism or you're talking about programming or you're talking about building the underpinnings of different things that we might be doing to move ourselves individually and ourselves as a group towards more freedom and so forth. And there's something that is, for some people, and this is not for everybody, but for some people, substance abuse can be something that really limits you. And this is going to sound like, oh, wow, they're going to go really downward direction with this. But no, not really. You know, in the late 70s, I was using pretty much any substance I could get my hands on, whether it be legal or illegal. I was pretty much open to try anything. It was kind of a thing of the 70s was, you know, just try it and see if you like it. If you've never tried it, how can you put it down? Well, that's a pretty dumb statement.
Yeah, really. It was I'll try anything once. And, you know, then like I think like the Manson family expanded that to murder, you know, which was kind of gave hippies a bad name. It was one of the things that gave hippies a bad name.
But I was asked recently I was talking to a person and they said, you know, that they're really trying to stop drug use. And they said, you know, I know, they said, Ben, I know you stopped drug use, and how did you do it, and how hard was it for you? And I said, well, you know, it's different for everybody. For me, my wife and I, right after we got married, actually it was about 3 months after we got married, we sat down and we talked about it, and we said, you know, we want to have kids. We don't want to continue this lifestyle where we constantly have to look at every headlight behind us to see if it's a cop, to check whether we have everything secure, is everything in the trunk, do we have anything showing, you know, every time a headlights pull up to the house, are we about to be raided? That was not the lifestyle that I wanted to bring children into.
Yeah.
And my wife and I agreed early on in our marriage that we wanted children. So we had this massive motivation to stop using anything that was illegal, and we did. And it was not easy. And there was, you know, in the first few months, there was falling back and there was moving forward. But we had this massive motivation, and we had each other to rely on. And within the first year, we were able to do it. We were able to stop all illegal drugs. And not only that, in conjunction with that, we both stopped all alcohol use at the same time. And later, we went back and drank again because it wasn't really a problem for us. The drugs were the problem, but alcohol wasn't a problem for us. But again, this is a very individualistic thing. So when the person was asking me about that, I wanted to emphasize to them that that was my motivation, and my support was my wife and my desire to have kids. But everybody is different, and how these substances grab hold of you and hold on to you is different in every single person. And some people, you know, that you don't have the luxury of having a motivation like children, or having somebody, a partner with you that you can rely on and lean on and so forth. Sometimes you got to go a different route. And I know, Michael, for you, you had a completely different situation. You took that in a completely different route. But the point that I wanted to make in this is that you can't, whatever kind of activism that you're trying to do, or however you're trying to live your life, if substance use is becoming a problem to you, and it doesn't really matter what the substance is. I had a cousin who had a really bad problem in the late 60s with nasal spray. And you might say, well, you know, that's, how can that be a problem? Well, it was. He was in sales, and he ended up on a business trip that he, you know, got an airplane fly hours and hours away, and he was in a place where he couldn't get the nasal spray that he had become dependent on. And he about went nuts. As it turned out, in the late 60s, basically methamphetamine was a major aspect of nasal spray that you could buy over the counter. And when he got to this new location where he was having this two-week-long business meeting, they didn't have that nasal spray. And he essentially went through meth withdrawals and almost wiped out his career over it because of the way he acted when he was trying to go through that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's different for everybody. There's all kinds of different ways of approaching this. But if it's affecting your life, and maybe, Michael, you can talk more about, you know, how to tell if an addiction is really in it, if use is an addiction, if that's a problem, and what a person can do about it.
Yeah, I could do that. Absolutely.
Well, we have, like, some people just stop cold turkey. Some people use a 12-step program. There's different ways of approaching this. So we're going to try to talk about that.
We'll be back to give you the truth about how to change your life from the ground up. Because we've done it on the Freedom Fiends.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Hi, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. The internet has lowered the cost barrier for a worldwide radio show to a price approaching zero. Yet there is one arena where you still need thousands of dollars to approach the audio quality of the corporate media. Doing a live spoken show with more than one host in different geographic locations. Our program, Fiend Phone, will solve that problem, and it will be given away free. Go to fiendphone.com to see what you can do to help. That's FEENPHONE.com.
Fiends, addiction and activism. addiction to activism. I don't like to use the word addiction callously. I don't like to say I'm addicted to this new pen I got. It's wonderful. Like, you know,
I'm addicted to butter.
Actually, some people can be addicted to food. I mean, that's but you know, I don't like saying I don't like using the word addiction in a way that undermines it, because it's a really serious thing. I was a heroin addict. I was a heroin addict and an alcoholic for a long time. Well, for about 10 years. Got sober 20 years ago, coming up on 21 years. And yeah, man, addiction ruins lives. The war on drugs ruins lives more. But if heroin and cocaine and speed were legal, they would still harm people. They harm people more because they're illegal. But and I don't think they should be illegal, because getting doors kicked in doesn't help anybody. It hurts people. Babies get flashbang grenades thrown in their crib. And the whole drug war is immoral. And it also leads to the war on guns. You know, if you're pro-gun like we are and you don't like drugs, you should not cheer the cops when they kick in the door for the weed or the powder down the street, because those cops are just training to kick in your door and take your guns. And you're not going to get to have your Waco moment or your Ruby Ridge moment of heroism and go out in a blaze of glory. You know, they're going to get you in the middle of the night and you're not going to wake up in time. They're going to know when you're asleep. They're watching your internet usage. They're watching your electrical meters. They know when you're deep asleep. They'll throw a flashbang through two different windows and come in and they'll know where you are. Or they'll just pull you over, you know, on the way to the dentist and handcuff you and take the keys out of your house and peacefully go. Well, it's not being peaceful, but without a fight, go take your guns when Hillary outlaws them in a couple of years. So, yeah, don't be in favor of aggression, man. Don't be don't co-sign the government beating people up. You know, if you say, I'd never be violent to people, I'd never aggress on people. But if you're voting, or even if you are saying, yeah, that's great when they take down those drug dealers, you are initiating aggression by co-signing aggression, because without a majority of the people saying that's good, it could not happen. You know, if it was treated like home invasions that it is, it wouldn't happen, man. And if cops couldn't murder people and get away with it, they'd be a little more careful. Although that gets into activism of trying to, you know, fix the state. It's not worth my time. I'll say that. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah. And this is a point that really confuses people about libertarians, because they see us on the surface from a distance and they think, oh, they just want drugs to be legal. And they kind of get this view like we're a one issue type of a thing. And it's really not. And we don't want drugs in every pocket. And we don't want your children taking drugs. We want a more logical approach to this problem. You know, drugs can be a problem, or not even drugs, but any substance that's addictive can be a problem for some people. But the answer to that problem is not the force of government, and not the government outlawing something, because black mark, forcing a prohibition on something only creates a black market. And when you create a black market, you create the potential for more violence, and you alter the actual market that's there. So an example of this was, you know, back in the 70s, the government very lightly enforced the anti-marijuana laws. There wasn't a big deal made about it. But then in the early 80s, you know, the government kind of ramped up its enforcement against marijuana, and it became a very serious charge to be caught with marijuana in some places, and they were actively pursuing that. And so the next thing you know, you've got a cocaine problem. And then so the government ratchets up its attack on cocaine, and now you've got a crack problem, and the government ratchets up its...
You know what the war on drugs does? The war on drugs, here's what it does, period. Other than ruining lives far worse than drugs, the war on drugs forces the market to make purer, better, stronger, cheaper, harder drugs far more available.
That's absolutely true. If you look in 1880, 1890, anybody could walk down to their local pharmacy and buy a codeine mixture or a
morphine. Or heroin.
A morphine-based mix.
And yeah. Early, you know, heroin was invented in the 1800s, but you know, you could buy it without a prescription in a drugstore in the 1800s. And what the war on drugs does, like, okay, you know, in the 50s, it was pretty hard to get marijuana widely outside of the jazz circuit. But, you know, cracking down on it drove the price up and created an incentive for an industry to develop. You know, before that, it was just kind of like, yeah, occasionally someone brought a pound back from Mexico and shared it with their friends. And, you know, occasionally someone, but you couldn't even grow pot that was good enough to smoke in the 50s. You know, it was available sporadically. And then it became really illegal. It drove the price up. The market existed for it. And then suddenly you had people driving, you know, light Cessna airplanes back and forth from Mexico once a month, you know, carrying 200 pounds of the stuff to one city. And then that was so profitable that, you know, they kind of branched out. The mafia got involved. They cracked down harder on the pot. And they realized, okay, you know, back then you could smuggle a pound of pot and, you know, sell it for $200. Or you could smuggle a pound of cocaine or heroin on the same plane and, you know, make 10 times that much. So it drove the market for harder drugs. Of course, there were some people that would never want to do harder drugs, most people. So there was still the market for pot. Literally, all the war on drugs does, other than ruining lives and stealing a bunch of tax money and creating a goon squad that will kick in your door for guns in a couple of years here, and already is in places. The only thing it does, the only market effect it has, is to do the complete opposite of what it's supposed to do. You know, every once in a while, the cops will bust some poor sap and parade him out and have the perp walk, and then have the perp walk on the table of things that are illegal. You know, the guns, money, and drugs they took away from him. But, it does not eliminate drugs. It does exactly the opposite. So, you know, the war on drugs, what it's done for is taken it from the 50s where, you know, if you hung out with some Negro jazz musicians on the wrong side of the tracks, maybe once in a while you could smoke a reefer stick. It's taken it from that to where, like, you can get heroin, cocaine, and speed and pot on pretty much any street corner in any major city, you know, in the badder sections of town and the good sections of town. And then you've got people to go into those cities and bring them into the suburbs. Like, literally what the government has done has provided somebody selling heroin, speed, and coke and crack in every suburban high school in America. That is because of the government, man. They say they do the opposite, but that's what they do.
And more government crackdowns do the opposite. They don't do what you think they do. And if you think that you can outlaw, you know, make more laws and fix the problem of drugs in schools, think about this. A school, essentially, we make the argument a school is essentially, you know, a low security prison. Kids are sentenced to be there for 12 or 13 years. They have no choice in the matter. Usually with the new ones, there's a fence around the thing. The only thing they're lacking is guard towers and machine guns. But let's take this a step further and let's talk about actual prisons. The government can't keep the drugs out of the maximum security prisons. So how can they possibly think that they could keep them off the streets if they can't keep drugs out of the prisons? Yeah, even the most controlled places in the world have drugs.
And weapons are extremely outlawed in prisons. Yeah, man. It's so square thinking that by outlawing a thing, you know, where there's no victim, where there's a thing, that you can do anything about it. I don't even know that outlawing murder cuts down on murder, but, you know, I think you have to punish someone when they murder people or steal from people or do something with an actual victim. But laws are punitive, you know, not rehabilitatory.
right, exactly. And so this brings us to the point of where the individual who uses any particular substance that might be addictive, the solution to that is not a collective mindset. It's not a collective answer. You can't make government from a top-down, central planning point of view. You can't have them fix the problem. The problem has to be solved on the individual basis, where the very first step is for the person who is using the substance to recognize that they have a problem. Now, Michael, you know the terminology involved in this. But isn't that the very first thing to realize, is that you have a problem on an individual basis and that it's your responsibility to do something about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the first step in any 12-step program, is, you know, admitting you have a problem. But it's not just saying, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, or yeah, I'm an addict, or yeah, I think the government, you know, I'm addicted to government and think it can fix all my problems, which is as ridiculous as thinking heroin is going to keep making you happy. You know, a lot of times in a 12-step program, the first thing that your sponsor, who's someone who's been there before you and knows the ropes, will do is have you write a first step, which basically means it's usually making a list of every way that you've compromised yourself for drugs or alcohol. You know, that you've spent the rent, that you got beat up scoring, that you did this or that. You know, a lot of that stuff is because of the government. I mean, you know, you have to hang out in alleys and you get beat up because it's illegal. If it was legal, that stuff probably wouldn't be as much of an issue. It wouldn't be as expensive. It'd be more pure. It wouldn't have as many trips to the ER connected to it. But drugs are still not hard drugs, you know, addictive drugs, being addicted to drugs. And you can't really do addictive drugs, coke, heroin, and speed occasionally. I believe you could smoke marijuana occasionally. I really believe it's kind of a different thing. But, you know, I know people that do it, but pretty much everybody who does hard drugs, even if they're prescribed, that's the thing. Like, even if they're legal and pharmaceutical, it ends up ruining people's lives. And they've got, you know, 10% of the kids or 20% of the kids in high schools on Ritalin too, which is speed. You know, they're basically like kicking in doors for the same stuff that they're making kids take, you know, that the school psychologist is making kids take in schools. It's a big racket. And, you know, the interesting thing too, hard drugs don't mix with activism. You know, there's a theory that the CIA, you know, smuggled cocaine, you know, in the 70s, was it, or 80s, and, you know, heroin in the 60s, to basically like keep people from getting too strong. You know, like really, like that's what kind of killed the Black Power movement in the 60s was heroin. You know, you can't be an effective activist when you're on hard drugs, even if the hard drugs were legal, but especially since they're illegal and expensive. Yeah. Whether or not the government actually did that, if they didn't do that, they should have done that for what the government wants to do, which is, you know, ruin everybody and be in control. So we'll be back with more
mind slaves
after this trip to the market, freeing yourself from the bondage of slavery on the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to the Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends, and I'm powerless over the Freedom Fiends. I guess I just did what I said that I don't like when people do. I kind of made light of addiction, but no, I was kind of making a happy out of recovery, not making light of recovery and not making light of addiction. Yeah. And there's a lot of things that people are addicted to other than drugs and substances, you know, gambling. I guess there's people who say they're addicted to sex. Although I heard some guy say on some TV show I liked, he said, "I'm sorry, I'm from the Midwest. Isn't that the same as getting a lot?" But apparently it's not. Apparently there are people who, you know, do it to the point where it harms them. And, you know, what I was saying earlier about doing a good first step, you know, admitting that you're powerless and that your life has become unmanageable. A lot of times a sponsor will have someone write a list of like ways that your addiction has compromised you, you know, financially, with friends, with your health, with your education, every, like just, you know, one line each, like spent the rent money, you know, crashed the car, you know, got beat up in an alley scoring drugs, any like lost the coolest girl in the world because, you know, I couldn't get off drugs. Like you make a list like that. And when you get to, oh, in my case, like, you know, 500 or 600 entries on it, it's pretty hard to look at it and say, yeah, I think I can have just one. And there's a difference between conceding to your innermost self that you have a problem and just saying you're an alcoholic. You know, I've been in a lot of bars where people are drinking and drunk and being alcoholics and heard them toast and joined in on toasts and made toasts like to alcoholism. That's not really admitting it to yourself. That's just saying the words. Admitting to yourself that you have a problem is, you know, and I'm paraphrasing here, the AA wording, it's conceding to your innermost self that you will do it till it kills you in a horrible death, you know, or you end up, you know, penniless and lying in a gutter, like reaching up blindly and trying to get spare change. I mean, that's really what addiction leads to, whether the thing's legal or not, and especially if it's illegal. But yeah, man, hard drugs aren't good. You know, it's, the thing is too, like, remember when Ron Paul, they basically got Fox News got, you know, the most consistent constitutionalist running for office ever kicked out of the race by having their first question to him, are you in favor of legalizing heroin? And he basically said, yeah, you know, and he's a doctor and he hates hard drugs. He would never do them. And, you know, he said something to the effect of like, the war on drugs does more harm than the drugs themselves. And, you know, I forget if he did it there or somewhere else, but he said at one point, like, you know, raise your hands if you'd start taking heroin tomorrow if it were legal. And like nobody raised their hand. You know, I probably would have raised my hand just to I'm kidding. Yeah. So Ben,
well, you know, you said something there that really struck a nerve with me, because it's something that I have experienced or that I have observed. I haven't been involved in it, but where you're at a party or you're at a bar or a social gathering of some kind where somebody says, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. They've got their beer in their hand or they've got their drink in their hand or whatever. And they say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I admit it. And then they like braggingly say, you know, why they're an alcoholic or whatever, and then have another drink. And I think that that's a game that they're playing with their own mind. It's kind of like a placebo to actually recognizing that they do have a problem and that they have to do something about it or die.
Yeah.
You know, they can say to themselves, well, I admit it all the time that, you know, that I'm an alcoholic. And that way they don't have to really admit it. It's a placebo that they can fall back on and justify their behavior to themselves. And I think in a way that's every time that I've heard that done, it just creeps me out because I think, dude, you're just lying to yourself.
Well, you can
by
tell,
saying the truth.
You can tell if somebody has conceded it to their innermost self, because when you finally say it out loud, it's not a happy affair and you're not toasting.
Yeah.
You're not having a drink when you're doing it. Yeah. It's a very, pardon the pun, sobering realization to like really concede that to yourself. With drugs or alcohol or people addiction, which I want to talk about in the second, you know, second hour about being addicted to bad relationships, which is a very serious thing. And it's a problem that a lot of people, I would say almost most people probably have to some extent.
Yeah. I was going to say, if you say that a phrase like that without any inner pain, then you don't really mean it.
Yeah.
It's not really coming from your heart.
And we'll be back with hour two of bringing you inner pain and redemption that comes after admitting pain on the Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market.
Hey, this is Squisgar Squigelts from Death Clocks, and you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Now that the elections are over and liberty has slipped even further away, it's time to try yet another political organization. Campaign for a Longer Leash is a nonpartisan group of pups and dogs dedicated to fighting for longer leashes for all. We're not talking about no leashes, that would be catarchy. We just want the limited leash that the Hounding Fathers promised us. As Bone Barklin once said, a longer leash if you can keep it, ma'am. For more info, go to facebook.com/campaignforalongerleash.
Freedom Fiends! Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker in the Alpha Centauri region. I'm your host, Mr. Michael W. Dean, and I am talking to my co-host, the host to my parasite, Mr. Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker. Are you there, Ben? Are you safe? Have you been contacted by the government?
I am safe, and I am almost never contacted by the government. I avoid those people as much as possible.
People. Are they people? I think they're robot aliens from the planet Xenon. I don't really think that, but and I don't really want to dehumanize people, but I think they dehumanize themselves when they're in the role of acting like the government and aggressing on people and messing with people's lives and laughing while they do it. What say you, sir?
I think actually from a psychological point of view, I think there's a basis in that. In order to aggress upon people on a mass scale like government employees do, they kind of have to dehumanize themselves and disassociate themselves from their victims. It's kind of like in that movie, what was it about the Silence of the Lambs, where the crazy guy who kept the ladies down in the dry well, he had to dehumanize them in order to abuse them. He couldn't talk to them like they were a person.
He called them it and spoke in the third person.
It rubs the lotion on its body.
Yeah. Yep.
And I think that's, you see that with police where they talk about, they're civilians, and they talk about them they talk about us like we are a different group of people from the police. They differentiate like the police are a different class.
More and more,
that's how they look at it.
More and more they talk about us like in terms of the enemy, like the general public is the enemy.
Yeah. They have to do that in order in their minds to justify their behavior.
Yeah, and that's a lot of that is a combination of things. It's a spillover of cross-pollination, a cross-contamination between police and military, especially with a lot of the older cops who might let someone go with a warning, retiring and being replaced with battle-hardened young guys with a lot of testosterone and possibly steroids and attitude and militaristic attitude who are, were serving in Fallujah a few years ago. Those are the ones they try to hire now. And the police getting totally armamented out with, army surplus tanks, weapons, night vision goggles, those speakers that split your ears and make you fall to the ground in pain. All the stuff that comes from the military, the police are getting it now. And, you've got these towns with like 160 people getting an MRAP, basically a tank with wheels. And the cops love it. They get to play G.I. Joe and drive around town and actually use those things to like show up to places where there's no need for it, to where someone's smoking a joint or, where there's kids drinking in the woods or any number of things, they will show up with these militarized vehicles and jump out either imagining or actually playing a heavy metal soundtrack and pretend that they're in an action movie and murder people. That happens more and more and more, man.
You know, and if you think just dressing up like you're in the military doesn't have some kind of a psychological effect, all you have to do is get around one of these nerd conventions where they do the cosplay. They dress up as superheroes or they dress up as these different things. And it really has a psychological effect on the person in the costume because you sort of take on the personality of the costume that you're wearing. That's part of the fun or part of the fantasy of dressing up in a costume like that, is that you sort of take on that personality and you, for a little while, you are Batman or you are Superman or whatever. And the same effect takes place when you dress up in military garb and start jumping around like you really are in the military. You take on, in your mind, you take on the effects of that, and it gives you the mentality that everybody you see who's not in your uniform is your enemy, and they are a threat to you.
Yeah, I was watching an episode of Status Victim Squad Stories, which is what I call Law and Order. new season just went up on Netflix, and I'm really excited about it. And there was an episode that was based on a true story, which was where a lady who had been a cop and also had been in the military basically went on a killing spree and killed a bunch of cops and then put herself in a situation to commit suicide by cop. And, you know, she had some vendetta. She left some video with her manifesto, you know, 4-minute rant on it. It was basically like, you know, the military had not expedited her mother's medical insurance and had hung on it and not done what they're supposed to do. And, you know, the mother died of cancer that was treatable before she could get the expensive treatment that the insurance was supposed to cover. And she was blaming the military and she was blaming police and, you know, wanted her pound of vengeance. And when she went on this spree, and it was, you know, kind of scary spree to the cops in this, and this is scary when it happens in real life, when like a battle trained, you know, officer turns on their own because they know all their tricks. They have the scanners. They know the code. They know the tactics. They know what they're going to do, and they're two steps ahead of them. When she went on this spree, she put on her her military uniform, and I'm like, that's kind of weird. I mean, it's going to make her stand out. It's not going to be as easy to blend in, and you know, she knows she's going to die. Why did she dress up for it? And I immediately thought, oh, because it puts her in the mindset, you know, of being able to kill and evade and run around in an urban setting and play commando.
Yeah, it kind of plays into the mental aspects of this. If we can possibly tie this back to the last hour, you know, you and I have talked lots of times about neuro-linguistic programming and how it's used to affect the mind. And some people think it's fake. Some people think it's not a real thing. And other people swear by it almost to the point of being cult-like about it. But really and truly, deep down inside, there's so many things in the brain that click other things in the brain that either justify your actions or influence you to take certain actions. And like we're talking about, dressing up in a costume like that is one of those things that clicks in your mind and sort of it brings in the fantasy level to justify behaving in a particular way. You know, otherwise, little kids wouldn't enjoy dressing up as whatever the thing is. Back in the olden days, we used to dress up as cowboys and Indians, but that became politically incorrect. But it's part of the fantasy.
And it was cops and robbers, that too. And cops and robbers was politically correct after cowboys and Indians was not.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, and back in the 60s, there was a lot of dressing up like army guys and fighting throughout the neighborhood with your neighbors. You were the Germans and they were the Americans, or you were the Americans and they were the Germans. We refought D-Day thousands of times among us little kids in the 60s.
And a lot of 60s radicals wore kind of paramilitary uniforms, you know, not with any flag or designation on them, but army fatigues. And you know, a lot of militia groups do that now too, dress up in camo and run around in the woods. Although, you know, the thing is, like, is it really in training exercises, it really has the opposite effect of camouflaging when it's in an urban setting. It stands out rather than hides you.
Yeah, which it really makes it odd that police would choose to. I mean, they don't always use camo, but when they do, it's kind of odd that they do that.
Yeah, like, I mean, in Ferguson, you know, a lot of the cops, and in Boston, after they were going door to door and violating people's rights during the after the Boston bombing, the police are indistinguishable from, you know, soldiers, American soldiers in the Middle East. They're wearing the same uniform and they have the same weapons. And they have some of the same training. They don't usually have as much training as the people in the military, which leads to ridiculous things like that picture of the cop, the sniper, the cop pretending to be a sniper up on a rooftop in Ferguson with like all of these tactical things wrong on his weapon, including like, you know, a left-sided weapon when he was right-sided, and, you know, just all sorts of things that were wrong with that picture. But yeah, they like to play dress up. And to lead this back to the addiction thing, I think that people are addicted to the state and to the illusion of protection that they think they get from the state. And the reason that the military industrial complex has joined the police industrial complex and policing has gotten more aggressive and more offensive instead of defensive, and more violations of people's rights being, you know, heard about every day. I mean, part of that is just everyone's got a camera in their pocket now. But, you know, really, like, what that leads to is tyranny in your own nation from within. You know, there was some founding father or some feisty guy back in the day. I don't remember who it was, but somebody said it might have actually been Lincoln, who's not one of my favorite guys, but not because he freed the slaves, but because he, you know, destroyed Americans and wanted to keep the federal family together. And slavery was on its way out anyway. And it was just an economic war that led to a real war on the South. But I think it was Lincoln who said something in effect of like, you know, America will never be conquered, you know, by a foreign enemy. It'll be conquered only from within. And I think we're seeing that happening now. And what causes that is basically people voting, getting ramped up by the media, being told there's something horrible happening, you know, whether it's crystal meth or whether it's Muslims or, you know, whether it's lone wolf people, you know, or gun owners being dangerous, or, you know, Christian churches that aren't approved and well known, or any number of things that scare people, that the media can use to scare people. And our friend Nima Vidati used to work for the mainstream media, and just he's done whole shows on here of like giving away their secrets of how that all works. It's not that there's some overlord giving commands down to the mainstream media. It's more like if it bleeds, it leads. If it's scary, it's news and people pay attention and don't change the channel. And even things that aren't scary, they make them scary because they want people to not change the channel. And they have to be pro-police because they want access to the local police. If you do a bad report on the local police and expose some corruption, they'll never give you anything other than, you know, their name again. They'll never give you the inside story, and the other news team in town will get the story and you'll lose viewers. So it's all economically driven. But that kind of stuff also drives people to vote for stupid things. And I don't just mean vote in the voting booth. That's secondary, I think, to like voting with their mouth and voting with their wallet and co-signing the BS of the state and of aggression and of coercion. People are addicted to that, man. They're addicted to the security theater of thinking that the government is right when they open their mouth and take over the mainstream media like they can at any point, and, you know, get free advertising with everything they do, to be able to say, well, there's danger. Only we can protect you from it. And nothing could be further from the truth. You just have to look at the war on drugs, man. They said drugs were scary. We have to stamp them out. And what they ended up doing was putting harder, cheaper, purer, better drugs in places they never got to before. And that's what the government does. The government does the opposite of what they say they're going to do almost every time. We'll be back after this trip to the real market.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin.
Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this. To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
Freedom Fiends. Neuro-linguistically reprogramming the statism out of your brain. We're not really into neuro-linguistic programming, but we're going to talk about it because we set it up. Now we're going to knock it down. So basically, neuro-linguistic programming is a set of techniques that were popularized, I believe, in the 70s as a way to – it was marketed a lot to salesmen. It's basically a bunch of things varying from running the gamut from when you're talking to somebody, using their name a lot, and mirroring their physical actions. Like if they tend to like kind of put their hand out when they make a point, like, you know, upside down, like, yeah, like kind of throw the thing, the question back to you or the statement back to you, or, you know, pound on the table when they make a point or do something. Neuro-linguistic programming involves kind of imitating them, but not in a way. It's basically trickery. It's basically psychological manipulation while you're talking to somebody. It can also be done like over a video, like when you're not talking to another person, but it involves a lot of things like looking directly into the camera, certain types of pauses. What else would you say, Ben?
You can do it by using very complicated sentences that don't actually make any sense, but saying them in such a way and so confident that it kind of breaks the person's defenses down because they think, I'm not sure exactly what he said, but it should be right. I mean, it sounded good.
Or coming out of left field with really personal questions, like if you're just starting to talk to somebody, you know, like for instance, if they're calling into the radio show, I've seen radio hosts do this or internet radio hosts do this, where a caller will come in and they'll immediately, you know, try to like talk about the person's childhood, which is not something you expect from a stranger. But it can build trust, like get the person to be, get people, the NLP user will use it on the, let's say, Mark, to get him to open up and trust. And there's a lot of, I'm really sorry that happened to you kind of stuff too. That's another aspect of it. Just trying to build trust, get into the person's brain and basically be able to root around and rewire it the way you want. That's how I describe it.
There's a really good video example of this with a hypnotist that does this to a cop. And I don't know if the video is legitimate or not. It could be totally fake. But the technique that he's using is a proven technique. And what the guy does, he's in Canada. He gets he sets up a cop to pull him over for a minor traffic violation. The cop comes walking up to his window, and the cop does his typical introduction. And the guy says, you know, hey, you know, I want to talk about that. And he clicks his finger, he snaps his finger as he's talking in a rhythmic way that distracts the cop's mind. And he says, you know, he's really friendly with the cop. And he says, I want to do that. But first, I want to ask you the reason I found you. He reverts it like if he found the cop. He says, the reason I wanted to talk to you was I'm trying to find a gas station. Can you help me find a gas station? And he turns the conversation around, and instead of the cop coming up in an aggressive manner, wanting to give him a ticket or wanting to stop him and search him or whatever, the cop is sort of reprogrammed in the conversation into his I want to help a citizen type thing. And the cop ends up telling him, oh yeah, you go down the street, you make a left, and over here's the gas station, here's how you get there. And the guy thanks him for it, and just he has essentially taken over the conversation and made the cop forget why he pulled him over. And they bill it on the internet like it's a mind trick, it's a Jedi mind trick. But really, it's not. It's the basic thing that a stage magician would do when he diverts your attention with one thing while he does something else. And this is really common with stage hypnosis. Put an extra S on there. But essentially what they want you to do is reveal something about yourself and then get you distracted on that and then put a thought into your mind that you weren't expecting to have and then get you to respond to it. It's a really well-established method for, you know, salesmen, managers, and bosses do it, therapists do it, and that kind of relates back to our earlier discussion about addictions. It can actually be useful in fighting an addiction, but evangelists do it, you know, cult leaders do it. In the olden days, this is the method, even though they didn't have a word for it, this is the method that mystics and shamans used to fool maybe a whole tribe into believing their magic and believing their shtick that they were, you know, portraying to the tribe.
Yeah, and it is considered a pseudoscience, but in the bigger sense that it can some people who are advocates of it claim that it can be used for everything from like curing alcoholism to the common cold. That stuff is pseudoscience, but it can be effectively used on impressionable people to manipulate them. Let's talk more about neuro-linguistic programming and how to recognize it. We're going to be careful with our words here, too, because this is a litigious organization.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. Cerebellum. Cerebellum.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty Projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiends message worldwide to as many liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
Freedom Fiends. We're talking about neuro-linguistic programming, which is, I think it's kind of sinister, but a lot of people swear by it. It's a commercialized methodology taught in seminars and books and VHS tapes and DVDs and all sorts of, you know, consulting. People pay big money to become experts at NLP or neuro-linguistic programming. It basically is involved nonverbal response, you know, guiding nonverbal responses from the client or the mark. And it's establishing and maintaining a rapport between the practitioner and the client with pacing, leading verbal and nonverbal behavior, and matching characteristics, mirroring nonverbal behavior, eye movements, hand movements of the client. And once the rapport is established, the practitioner gathers information about the client's present state to help the client, to, you know, to help define what the practitioner can do. It's you to the person, you know. Businesses spent millions of dollars sending salesmen and managers to these classes. Basically, it is a method, as far as I can see, my opinion is that it's a method for in a very planned way, manipulating people. And I've had it done to me. I have a not immediate family, but, you know, relation. There's a relation in my family that studied this and was really into it and recommended it to me about, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Like, oh, you know, you do media stuff. You'd get a lot out of this. You should study it. And I read up on it a little bit. I'm like, this sounds wicked in a bad way. It sounds wicked, not wicked cool, but wicked evil. It sounds like, you know, studying how to manipulate people and hypnotize them and make them do your bidding. And I'm not down with that, man. That sounds like the government to me. So I was not interested.
It's like the dark arts.
It is the dark arts for salesmen. Yeah. And you know, I can't really talk to, I never really liked that relative of mine for no reason that I could discern. But once I knew that he was in NLP and I looked it up and studied it, I could see him doing it to me and everyone he dealt with. And it made me really not want to deal with him. And I think it's really good to be able to recognize it. What do you say, Ben?
You know, I mentioned the last hour about a relative I had. It was actually my cousin who was on a business trip and couldn't get his nasal spray back in the 60s and kind of lost it because he was addicted to meth and didn't even know it at the time. But that same guy he's deceased now, but at one point in time, I thought that a good way for me to get out of the nasty company that I was working for was to become an insurance salesman. It seemed like an easy way to get in and do something, provide a service that people needed, and make decent money on it. So I started studying up on being an insurance salesman, and I was really, really bad at it. So my cousin, who was an extremely successful salesman, and this was early 80s, he had been a salesman, you know, all the way through the late 60s and all the way through the 70s. And so he came to my parents' house, and I went to my parents' house, and we kind of had this meeting where he's going to show me how to be a good insurance salesman. And he started, he didn't use the phrase neuro-linguistic programming or NLP, but he started showing me these techniques and how to snap your fingers and how to look a person in the eye and how to repeat their name every 30 seconds, say their name, or every 15 seconds or something. I can't remember the exact technique. But look them in the eye, repeat their name, touch them on the shoulder or touch them on the hand, or there was these things that he would do to disarm your mind and then put it into your head how important it was that you buy the product. And when I got done talking to him that evening, I really felt creeped out. And I went back home and thought everything over, and it was about a week or so after that that I stopped selling insurance because it really was not something that I felt comfortable being a part of. And over the years, I've started to see that technique in one way or another used in all kinds of different settings. And I suspect that somebody like, you know, the legendary Russian mystic Rasputin, that essentially took control of the royal family in Tsarist Russia,
yes,
and manipulated them.
Yes.
It's very likely he used those same techniques even before it had a name, even before it was called anything, because he would do this with his eyes. He would look right at a person deeply into their eyes, use their name, touch their hand, and ask them very, very private questions, sometimes shocking questions. And in doing so, he would literally get control of their mind and convince them that they needed him in their life in order to function. It's a really creepy thing.
Yeah, I would suggest running from anybody who uses a bunch of these techniques, whether they call it that or not.
Yeah, and again, I'm talking about people who do this in person. It, like you mentioned, it can be done through video. It can be done over the radio. It can be done, you know, I hate to say it, but it's a standard evangelist trick.
It's harder to do over radio. It'd be easiest to do in person, second easiest to do over video, you know, that's live, where it's two people looking at each other in video. Third hardest would be in a video that's not, you know, that's pre-recorded. Fourth hardest, I think, would be, you know, radio, where you don't have feedback from the person. A lot of it involves feedback. It could be done over the phone easier than one-way radio show. But, it could be done.
I think a lot of cold readings, I'm sure you're familiar with.
I was just going to say that, man. Yeah, go ahead with that. Yeah.
Well, and we should define that. If you have, let's say, a person who claims themselves to have some kind of magical mind-reading capabilities.
Like speaking to the dead.
In touch with the spirit. Yeah, in touch with the spirit world or whatever. And oftentimes the trick that they use will be to ask you some very vague questions, like, were you born here, there, were you this? And what they're actually doing is they're gleaning from you some private information that they're going to then make some assumptions from and lower your defenses. And so they're talking to you. They know that you're in your 40s. They can assume that you're either married or you've been married. And so they can start to...
They start, you know, if you're in your 40s, they usually start with, so, I'm getting that you have children, and you know,
yeah,
a lot of people in their 40s do. So,
or there are children close to you in your family, or there are children close to you in your life, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's even vaguer because everyone has a nephew or something. But you know, and they'll even do it before they start talking to the person with who they pick out of the crowd. They'll kind of look at people and kind of read like who looks the most receptive, or you know, sometimes they'll cheat and they'll know a little bit of information ahead of time about the person. You know, Houdini was big on that. Houdini would send his spies to a town before he went to do a magic show, and you know, have them find out things about people in the audience and do things like, you know, when he would, this isn't really NLP, but you know, when he would like challenge any local police department to lock him up and, you know, then he would escape, you know, he would have them break into the police station and see like what kind of handcuffs they had, because they weren't standard back then, and things like, you know, he would have them like take them apart and make a key that would fit to them that he could hide somewhere.
Yeah. You know, another very famous example of this was a Canadian, I won't name his name, but there was a Canadian TV evangelist who had these big giant meetings, and people would come from everywhere to get healed or whatever. And when they would come in, they would be given a card to fill out, a prayer request card. And you put your name on the top, you put the city you're from, and you put maybe even your address, and you put what you wanted prayer for, you know, my bum leg or blind in my right eye or whatever. And then they, without the person knowing it, they kept track of what seat that person went to. And then the evangelist had a little earpiece in his ear, and his wife was off stage reading those cards. And she would say, over in section E in seat 26, there's a guy named Bob Williams, and he's worried about his grandmother. And so the evangelist would say, let's see, Bob Williams over here. Let's see, in this section right here, is there a Bob Williams? Son, you're worried about your grandmother. And this would throw that person into a position of lack of defense. It would put their defenses down. And then he could just go up and say all kinds of things, touch them on the forehead. They would pass out. He had all kinds of power over them because it was all in their own minds, because they had already laid down their defenses. And this guy was busted. Actually, I think James Randi was one of the people that busted him in doing that. They went in with the recorder, found the frequency that he was, that his wife was broadcasting to, and recorded the whole conversations of his wife doing this. It was quite a scandal back in the day.
Yeah. 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 You know what? Who else uses NLP is those people who teach, like, you know, pickup artist stuff, like for men to be able to sleep allegedly with any woman, which I think is a kind of sinister thing. I mean, not like women are some, you know, not like it's aggressing on someone to sleep, to plan to sleep with someone and then do it, but that it's kind of people who, I don't know. I back in the day, I was kind of a player, I guess what you'd say, but I actually felt like I was having relationships with everybody. I was, you know, I wasn't like, it wasn't a conquering thing. And the thing for me too was, I realized this last night, I've thought about this, and this is probably the most sinister thing I ever did, and it's not very sinister, is part of the reason, other than, you know, being willing and wanting and able to, you know, have relations all the time when I was younger, and you know, still pretty good for 50. They could bottle me and sell me to other 50-year-olds. But the thing that really drove me to do that, I realized it, was I was kind of addicted to, I don't even know if addicted is the word, but I really got off on fascinating people. You know, I really got off on, like, I used to say that I could sleep with any woman I could make laugh, because it was basically true back then. There was just something about the way that I could communicate with people one-on-one, like, you know, a man or a woman, and I'm not talking about sleeping with men or women, I'm talking about just like meeting somebody, and within 5 minutes, my whole life, I've had this ability to, like, not with everybody, but with a pretty large percentage of the population, to just sit down with them and immediately, like, they want to know everything about me. They're really into how I listen, and I listen genuinely, but I talk a lot. And it doesn't work on a certain percentage of the population, which is why I've always made friends really easy, but also, like, made enemies without trying. Like, some percentage, like 20% of people just despise me. You know, they talk to me for 5 minutes and they're like, oh, I hate that guy. But then, like, you know, a lot of people I would just fascinate, and then I'd end up sleeping with them, because that was the natural thing to do when you're, you know, mutually fascinated with somebody. So I've always been into fascination and fascinating people. And I always thought it was, I think it's a little more organic than something like NLP of trying to hypnotize people into a sales scenario or a seduction scenario or a, you know, love the government scenario. I think the government does it too. But yeah, man,
yeah.
I'm using mine for good, never for evil these days. Yeah, it's pretty much never evil. So we'll be back with redemption in the third act after this trip to the free market.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Shiny badges on your jacket. Shiny badges.
This is Davi Barker from shinybadges.com, and I just want to personally apologize for airing a jingle week after week, month after month, that turned out to be such an infectious brain worm. So to make it up to you, I'm offering a free gift. The next time you make a purchase at shinybadges.com, write worms in the transaction comments, and I'll send you something weird.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most of our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Freedom Fiends, Redemption in the Third Act, from Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, and myself, Michael W. Dean, the cranky hamster. Now, what am I? I forget. The iron hamster. And I did want to make a statement about FiendPhone. We are using FiendPhone to connect over the internets to each other. We're not using Skype. It does sound better than Skype, but it doesn't sound as good as FiendPhone can be, and not as good as it sounds with other hosts. Because Ben is using wireless internet 4G connection. So that's never going to sound as good for voice over internet protocol for VoIP as a wired, you know, in your home DSL or cable line. So Ben, go ahead and redeem us and bring us on home.
Sure. So, you know, we've talked about in the first hour, we talked about addiction and we talked about to a certain extent how the government messes with your mind, but also how you know, substances, alcohol, heroin, whatever it is, whatever is that monkey that's on your back. We talked about how those things can affect you and how important it is to free yourself from those things. If you get to the point in your life where you recognize that you have that monkey on your back, you have to deal with it at some point. Otherwise, you know, it will eat your life. And it's for some people, It actually means your life. It means you're going to die because of it. It's going to cause you to get in a situation where you're going to choose your addiction over living. But for other people, you know, they suffer for years and years and years with an addiction, and they just try to ignore that thing that's just riding them constantly. And that's not a good life. That's not a way to live. To be free of it is the way to live. And whether we're talking about literally an addiction, something that you know, introduce into your body through a vein or through your nose or through drinking it or through smoking it or whatever the thing is, or whether it's some outside influence. We're talking about, you know, believing that the government is your savior, believing that police are your friends, believing that all of your problems in life can be solved by one more law.
Believing that that medium is actually talking to your dead grandmother and giving you messages of hope, or, you know, believing that internet radio show podcaster guy with the videos where he has the fun accent and sounds really believable, and I know that as a child you were touched in bad ways, you know, that like if somebody's doing like hoodoo or NLP or something on you through the internet, don't buy it, man.
All those things are in essence a type of slavery that you're allowing yourself to be in. You don't have to be in that situation. You can free yourself. And what we talked about was recognizing these things and admitting to yourself on a deep level, a level of where when you say, yes, there is a problem here, and when you say it, you actually feel that little twinge of pain deep inside, acknowledging that it's something that is eating you, that's controlling you, that is manipulating your life, and that it's altering your life and keeping you from the kind of freedom that you deserve, that you need, that would make your life better. And you know, there's an old saying from the 60s, free your mind and your body will follow. Now, there's a lot of nonsense that came from the 60s, and there were a lot of movements. You know, there was the beat movement, and there was the hippies, and there was the yippies, and there was all these communes, and there was all kinds of nonsense that came out of the 60s. But each one of those little groups and each one of those movements had a little something that we can learn from nowadays. And that phrase, free your mind and your body will follow, it actually has some substance to it, in the sense that you can't really be free if you've got an addiction, if you've got that monkey on your back that's constantly forcing you to go back and you know, hit that thing one more time, or go back and
hit the lever of internet philosophy from the one true whoever who you think is bringing it to. And you know, when you confront people with the fact that they may be being duped, they fight it. They fight you, whether it's the state or some internet podcaster, video guy, or whether it's, you know, the medium taking your money and thinking they're talking to your grandmother. And really, here's a quote I'm going to end with. It's Harriet Tubman, who helped free a lot of slaves, said, "I freed 1,000 slaves, and I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves." And that's that speaks to admitting you have a problem. Can't stop being a slave. Yeah, you can't stop being a slave if you don't know you're a slave, man. We'll do more on this topic next time. We didn't even touch the surface, man. It's going to be a 10-part series with Ben Stone and I dealing with
addiction. And we got 11 more steps to go.
I could do 10 more on the first step, man. All right. We'll be back tomorrow on the Freedom Fiends. Thank you for listening. Worms.